This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and with this we'll talk with Meredith Colias-Pete, who is an education reporter for the Post Tribune. And Meredith, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've had a number of good stories out in print as well as online in the Post Tribune this week. Let's start with the one here that maybe we'll need a little explanation first. And this is about the story involving the Indiana Court of Appeals and what kind of impact that a ruling that the appellate court is made that could turn effect a civil lawsuit that's involving a couple of former Munster school administrators. First, for those that are not familiar with the case, fill us in on who Richard Sopko and his colleague at the time, William Pfister, had to do with the school town of Munster, I should say, and what they were doing and how this has ended up going to court.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a case that's sort of been ongoing for about 4 or 5 years now. You know, just a little backstory. William Fitzgerald and Richard Sopko were school administrators in Munster. And so this case dates back to about 2015 or so. They are accused over a decade of sort of siphoning off about $840,000 in school funds to their retirement accounts. So the backstory on that is that it goes back to about 1999, and they're accused of setting things up. And so from 1999 to about, 2013-14, setting things up so that the school district was paying a snowballing contribution to their retirement annuities. And at the end of this decade, it turned out to be like $840,000. Now, during all this process, the Munster School Board, which has a responsibility as an elected board to sort of hire superintendents and go over the finances and making sure that, school money is being spent how it's supposed to be spent, they were sort of accused of being asleep on the job because you have these regular public meetings where, they look at, all these detailed finances, and they're, signing off on vouchers and payments to these men that apparently they're not reading the fine print on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of an important thing in this, because, no one in Munster seems to realize that this was going on for over a decade until these two men were out the door. So it's dating back to, 1999, and covering a period of really almost 15 years, like I said, to 2013, 2014 or so. What you have in that period, you have a couple of new school board members coming in, 2014-ish or so. They're going back and catching this and catching the fact that these men are getting all these payments that the school board did not approve in their contracts. And so they went to the school district's lawyer, who's filed a legal complaint, and notified prosecutors and notified the State Board of Accounts, which is this public auditing agency where these public auditors come in and they check the books of the school district, right?
Yeah.
And so that's 2015 is an important point in this case. So this is basically where this all breaks open and everybody realizes what's been happening. The State Board of Accounts goes through and they go through and they do a much more thorough audit between 1999 and 2014 or so, and they validate this. They validate these concerns that these men have been paid money that they shouldn't have been paid. And then they forward that. And that gets completed in about June of 2016, right? So we're full 17 years later. That gets forwarded to Attorney General Curtis Hill's office. Curtis Hill turns around about a year and a half later, May 2017, and he files a lawsuit to get back money from these two men. So that's kind of the backstory.
Yeah. What kind of ends up now going to local court now?
That's kind of moving the case forward. So there's two problems with this that's really kind of been this case that the state and the lawyers for these two men have kind of been, going back and forth on. The problem is that there are, officially there are checks and balances in place to, look at these agencies, like a school district, for example, and make sure that are you spending the money the way that you're supposed to be spending it, right? And that would be the school board, which, was accused during this whole period of not doing their job, not doing due diligence, and signing off on these payments, right? And the other is the State Board of Accounts, which by law audits the books of a school district every 2 years. And one point that I do want to make sure that I make is that it's come out in court filings that these auditors don't regularly look at retirement annuities. And so Curtis Hill's office has, said that this is a blind spot that they're alleging that these men knew about, right? So if you're sitting there and you're a very experienced school superintendent, you know how school finance works, how the ins and outs, you know when auditors come in, you know, what are they going to check every 2 years, right? Curtis Hill's office has alleged that these men knew that that was a blind spot, that they knew that, the auditors were not going to come in as a regular practice and match up the retirement accounts to be like, is this what, you know, you're supposed to be getting paid in your contract, right? So he's alleging that they knew that this was a blind spot, and if you allegedly were looking at siphoning off money from the school district, that would be a perfect place to do it where it might not be noticed for a while. Now, last year, the fight is, the lawyers for these two men are arguing, hey, this isn't theft because the Munster School Board signed off on it for years and years and years. The Munster School Board is saying they didn't pay attention. And of course, there's a new board in right now. And the other thing is about the statute of limitations. This case has a 5-year statute of limitations, and that basically means Hill's office has 5 years to come in and file a lawsuit. Now, Fitzgerald and Paslow's attorneys are saying, hey, the statute of limitations should start, you know, back at the very beginning, like around 1999 when this first started.
Right.
And in that case, obviously, then that would have been long expired. Hill's office is arguing that, no, that they didn't find out about this until 2014, and then the audit came out in 2016, and that, you know, things had to go through the process for them to have a case. And Hill's office is arguing, hey, the audit came out in 2016. They filed a year and a half later to get the money back. They're arguing that they're within the statute of limitations, right? So last year, the case was in Lake County Superior Court in front of Judge Marissa McDermott. She ruled, gave a partial ruling saying that the statute of limitations, she set the statute of limitations in 2012, which was exactly 5 years before Hill filed his lawsuit. Now, what that means in actuality at that point is that 2012, these men were basically out the door. They were, on the cusp of retiring. If you look at where the money was siphoned off, most of the money was already allegedly siphoned off to them by that point. So what that means is if you set the statute of limitations at 2012 where the wrongdoing is starting, that they already got paid by that point, pretty much. And so it basically threw out most of the case. And uh-huh. So Curtis Hill appealed at this point. The most recent development in this is that you have this unrelated case in Jennings County, which is in southeastern Indiana. A woman who is, an ex-county bookkeeper is accused of stealing $60,000 from the county, dating back 2009 to 2011 or whatnot. That case had a 2-year statute of limitations. The court came back and ruled that the legal clock, that statute of limitations, only starts when the audit comes back, with evidence that she took the money, right? And so it tells Hill's case that, if he sued within that 2 years, which he did in that case, it basically makes the whole case valid, right? And so he turns around and their lawyers file in the Munster case and they're saying, hey, look at this other case. Applies to Munster as well.
It sounds like that the Court of Appeals has now got to do some comparing and contrasting of these measures with the one that happened, with the situation in Jennings County with what's the situation in Munster. And it'd be interesting to see what comes about if this does come back up. And it raises a question, and maybe it's not yours, of course, necessarily, I guess, to look at, Meredith, but it's something I think might be worth considering, that maybe the State Board of Accounts needs to do some updating of how they do their school district audits when they do them, since they do them as a routine, that maybe they should make sure that they get in touch with TIAA and the other organizations that set up annuity accounts for teachers and other professionals, and maybe they should do some review on these things. So that might be something that will probably come in the future too, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking about that this morning, too. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that. I was actually going to ask them that, so I can always let you know.
Well, TIAA, well, I'm sure it will be more than happy to cooperate with the city of Indiana if they need to on this particular case, too. One of the other great stories that you had out here was something we have to think about, and certainly school districts as well as governmental agencies and others have to think about here, is the losing of the tax caps on property taxes in 2020. And I know that was one of the topics that came up recently. I understand at a recent forum dealing with not only school budgets, but also what the General Assembly is doing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, a week or so, you had a couple of, school business managers and a state lobbyist for education come through Maryville High School and, kind of just gave a rundown for what's left in legislature. We're in a budget session this year, so lawmakers are down there in Indianapolis deciding how the money, state money is going to get spent over the next year, so it really is an important time to pay attention to. And that was definitely one of the things that came out. They were kind of giving a rundown on kind of the state of school finance today.
Do they seem to show some concern, or are the people there certainly at the forum have some real concern that the tax caps will disappear here in Lake County in 2020 and they're going to have some real problems? I know that that's come out before, especially when we've had our spate of school tax increase referendum that some passed and some haven't in particular, and they're very worried about what happens in 2020. They're not going to have the money to pay the bills and keep operations going.
Yeah, absolutely. And every single school finance business officer that I talk to in Lake County is very, very, very concerned about this. Just some background, 10 years ago or so, there was a lot of complaints out there that, property tax bills for homeowners, et cetera, were getting way too high. The legislature, passed tax caps at that point. But they did phase them in for Lake County and St. Joseph County because they would have just taken a huge hit, too fast at that point. Fast forward, right now, 2020, they're supposed to fully apply. Schools are going to be, one of the government entities that are going to be most profoundly hit because it deals with at least like debt that they've been accumulating before 2008, which was sort of exempt from these property tax caps, but that's going to be completely gone away in 2020. You see where that's going to hit in Lake County. More than likely, those northern districts that we talk about a lot are going to get hit hard. Gary, Hammond, Lake Ridge especially, some southern county school districts like Hanover comes to mind have had a little bit more time, not time per se, but better resources to sort of pre-plan for this, where the northern counties are kind of, dealing with a lot more financial issues, certainly. And so I hope I'm answering your question. But, yeah, it's definitely something that that's on their mind. You have district after district, asking voters for a referendum. The latest example of that is River Forest, for example, by New Chicago. They're asking for a referendum because they believe they're going to lose, $850,000, something like that, under the tax caps in 2020. For them, what they say that means is their school buses cost about $600,000 a year. So if they say this referendum fails, those tax caps go through. They say they don't know how they're going to be able to pay for that.
Yeah, and that's the same situation that we know this came out during this past election when the Lake Ridge New Tech School District asked for the referendum because they are fearing that that's going to be the same situation that if it's now that they didn't pass, unfortunately, they're going to have to do some major changes to their transportation fleet. And that's going to be tough for them, I know, because that's a school district where they're basically in neighborhoods with no sidewalks, so students can't walk to school. They have to take the bus, and they don't have much choice. One of the other things, I know that they took up at the forum, if you'll give us an update on here, is dealing with the teacher pay. What is what the folks that had this forum have to say about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Teacher pay obviously has been a big issue in the legislature this session. It's not anything that's new. It's dated back several years. What we're seeing in the legislature this year in the budget session is you're not really seeing any real movement on teacher pay, meaning lawmakers aren't setting aside any real increases that are specifically designated for teacher pay, if that makes sense. There's a couple of bills around in the legislature. One that was publicized by, you know, House Speaker Brian Bosma was one there. School districts would be encouraged to shift around money in their own budgets, meaning 85% of their budgets of the money that they get from the state, you know, they're encouraging should be used for classroom expenses, teacher pay, instructional expenses, and then you're limiting the other 15% to what they call operational expenses. And what that means is, like, you know, school buses, NIPSCO bills, you know, paying superintendents, stuff like that.
Right.
In that case, what you have is a lot of the, local districts, public school folks are turning around and saying that, a lot of these schools are rarely strapped for cash, and, you know, they don't have the money to move around. And even if they did, they would have done it already. Jennifer McCormick, who has the Department of Education, has also said that she feels that's not really, like, a very constructive solution to an issue. Obviously, with teachers across the state of Indiana, she has put forward the statistic where, the new teachers, the ones that are in the first 5 years of their career, I don't remember actually the statistic, but a majority of them who leave within 5 years, about a third, I think, actually.
Yeah.
A third of them who leave within 5 years are citing, teacher pay, not getting raises to allow them to, have a decent wage or, things of that nature. So there's also another bill that's also in the budget. Holcomb came out and saved the state recession and basically said that they're going to use $150 million from the state surplus to help schools pay off some of their pension debt. The idea is that, these schools, and if that's paid off, then they can turn around and use some of that freed up money for teacher pay. But you do have some public school people and folks saying that, if you have money from the state that's not specifically, it's not specifically earmarked for teacher pay, there's no guarantee that's going to trickle down for that purpose.
Well, Meredith, we have just enough time left to talk about Mark Casanova, a gentleman who is a high school graduate from Whiting, and he has picked up a very interesting distinction of being, I guess, the first male Latino nurse graduate from IU in, what, nearly 15 years? Tell us about that and have what he had to say about this special distinction he now holds.
Yeah, it's a really good story. Mark is a 2015 Whiting High School grad. He's down at IU Bloomington right now studying nursing. And it looks like when he finishes in May, like you said, he's going to be the first Latina male grad in some time. He has a classmate named Larry Wilson, who's going to graduate in May as well. Larry is from Indianapolis, and IU believes that Larry as well is the first, black male nurse to graduate, from IU at the same time. Like, historically from the School of Nursing, if you were a student that went there, you could start in Bloomington, but you would finish at IUPUI. Now, that changed in about 2005 or so when IU added Bloomington as a campus where you could graduate from if you were a nursing student. So they went back and checked the books, and it looks like these gentlemen both are trailblazers, at least since they allowed graduating students, there from IU Bloomington in 2005 or so. They both figured this out, or the school told them maybe this is the semester, past couple months or so. And it's really been a motivator for both of them. They really have taken it to heart, and they said that they both want to be, examples to other minority students, and just to say, hey, I did it, you can do it too.
Well, it sounds like these guys are really, really enthused, not only about training to become nurses and what you have to consider is a female-dominated profession, but they're certainly going to take advantage of the learning that they have and move it on and do well, I guess, whichever happened to be their next assignment after graduation. And thank you, Meredith, for bringing us up to date on these stories and others, and we hope to talk to you again real soon.
Thank you, Chris.
Meredith Colias-Pete is a reporter who covers education stories for the Post-Tribune. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio is Regionally Speaking. Let's check in with Giles Bruce with The Times. He covers generally healthcare news for the newspaper, both in print and online. And Giles, thanks very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, one of the things we wanted to talk about that we have down here lately that you've had a chance to go into more detail about in your stories is dealing with people who are trying to recover from addiction and how some of the healthcare providers are helping people learn better, and particularly when we're dealing with this drug epidemic that's out here. Fill us in with what that story is all about.
The most recent story I did was coverage of a forum that was held, an all-day forum in Michigan City at the Blue Chip Casino earlier this month. It was primarily a conference for social workers, but they brought together people from a variety of fields, from pharmacology, from public health, from emergency medicine, psychology, drug treatment, and then people who are in recovery themselves from addiction to just kind of try to figure out how to tackle this crisis from all angles.
Mm-hmm. Is there any particular type of therapy or strategy that most people have found that seems to work, at least what the healthcare officials say?
There's a variety. I mean, often what works for one person doesn't work for another, but, there's always the traditional, 12-step model of recovery, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. It's been there for decades, and that has, varying degrees of success depending on who you are. But then there's some of the newer models like, medication-assisted treatment. That's primarily for people, opioid addicts, people who are on heroin and painkillers and whatnot. And there's drugs like Suboxone and methadone and Vivitrol is the other one. These drugs that people use to kind of beat the cravings and then, kind of use that to, help them get by and to get some treatment, some therapy mm-hmm. While they're on those medications.
From the people that you've talked to and putting together the story, we hear an awful lot lately here about CBD oils. How helpful do they seem to be in the therapy process from what you learned?
CBD has a variety of uses. It's been around a long time, but it's basically just been formally legalized recently in Indiana. It's the part of marijuana essentially that doesn't get you high, and it has some medicinal benefits. People say it can help with inflammation, sleep problems, anxiety, pain relief. It's not a cure-all, but some people do swear by it. And at this conference, it was mentioned that some people have been using it even to get off of opioids to help with the withdrawal from opioids.
Mm-hmm. I know recently, and you included in your story, that the state health commissioner, Dr. Christina Box, had to speak out at a forum in Michigan City not long ago about the problem of pregnant women who unfortunately are drug addicts as well, and not only what impact it has on the children, but themselves as well. What did you find out with that, with what Dr. Box had to say?
Yeah, Dr. Box spoke at the forum as well. This is one of the main areas in the state of Indiana is focusing on, and its efforts to go after the addiction crisis and focusing on pregnant women. Moms in Indiana give birth to babies dependent on opioids at a higher rate than the national average. I've done some reporting on that in the past. So they're trying to pass a law now. They could be pretty close to having the governor sign it, but this would essentially require that doctors, OBGYNs, ask women about their drug use when they come in when they're pregnant. We would be one of the first states, if not the first, to require that. And they're also, the state's been opening more and more drug treatment centers that allow women to come in with their babies and with their young kids and have them stay with them. There's ones now in Indianapolis, Winchester. Mm-hmm. There's others opening soon in Evansville and Columbus.
Well, I'm not surprised that we find one already open in eastern Indiana, because I know you've noted, and you probably noted from what you see out there in the clips, about the fact that there are some sections of Indiana that are really, really hard hit by the opioid epidemic, and people are having difficulty trying to recover from addiction out there. So it's not surprising that they'd have a center open up in some place, which is in Winchester's right north of Richmond. So there's a big area there that they probably have a lot of people they can help.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they're opening those strategically in places where there is addiction. And like you said, that eastern Indiana area near the Ohio border has been pretty hard hit, as well as southeast Indiana. you know, where they had that HIV outbreak a few years ago, has been particularly hard hit by opioid use as well.
We're talking with Giles Bruce, who covers healthcare issues for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And one of the other stories that luckily is a little more pleasant topic to talk about that you've had out there in print and online has to deal with therapy dogs. Tell us how you got onto that story and what you came out with.
Yeah, well, the Munster Hospital, the Franciscan Hospital, Health Hospital in Munster, which is right near our office here, they recently started a pet therapy program where on Wednesday afternoon for a couple hours, volunteers bring in dogs into the hospital and go and visit the patient rooms. They visit with the, you know, even the nurses, the doctors, the staff. But it's primarily there to help patients just to kind of relax, you know, take their mind off things. And, you know, research has even shown that this, you know, helps patients in their recovery, particularly with relaxation and motivation. It kind of, you know, helps maybe put a smile on their face or get their mind off, kind of what could be a dark time for some.
I know that you talk about a number of patients in the story that had reactions whenever they may have been in their hospital room, but when the dog came in, they really piped up and showed a lot of improvement, I suppose.
Yeah, they really did. Yeah, you know, a few of them in particular just really perked up and started petting the dogs, and they would, you know, kind of talk about their dogs or dogs they've had that have passed or dogs they have at home. So, you know, it's just something that gave patients a break. I mean, if anything, this can't hurt. You know, it's not like it's, you know, going to have side effects or anything like some other, you know, healthcare treatment. So, kind of a cool program. They've been doing it at their Crown Point Hospital, Franciscan Health has, for a few years now. They also have it at their Michigan City Hospital. And then the Hartsfield Village Nursing Home in Munster also has a program like this. And then one of the cancer oncologists at Porter Regional Hospital will bring in her dog from time to time to work with patients there.
Well, it sounds like it's a great story, and it sounds like it's a great way to help improve the healing process, to be sure, and people are learning more about the benefits of therapy dogs, and that's what we got out of the story, and we appreciate you taking time, Giles, to talk about that and the other stories that you've had out there recently, and we hope to have you back again on Regionally Speaking soon.
I'd love to do that.
Giles Bruce,
nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you. Giles Bruce is the healthcare reporter for The Times. We'll continue on now with the Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. And we talk now with Joe Peet, who's the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start out here with the stories that you've had out in print and online here with some sad news here of an unusual fatality. I guess it doesn't happen every day, but it does happen. There's an incident involving a steel mill fatality, and the latest one we note was reported here just a few days ago. And it's been a while since we've had one, I guess, several years at least.
Oh yes. Well, it's been the steel mill deaths are pretty. They're at least usually a few a year. This was the first in 15 months that the ArcelorMittal Indiana Harbor steel mill in East Chicago, the former Inland Mill on the east side, this was the first there in since December of 2017. But unfortunately, tragically, steelmaking does remain very difficult, dangerous work, and we usually do have a couple fatalities at the mills every year, whether it's a steel worker or a contractor. But in this case, it was a steel worker. He had been working there for 17 years. He had been working in the same area for some time. So it wasn't one of those circumstances where he was unfamiliar with the work area. But it was a 49-year-old Schererville man, Edwin Fleming, who was killed in a railroad accident on a Tuesday. And it's currently it was in a fatal train accident. There was he was fatally injured by an engine. He was operating when it struck a rail car in an adjacent track. It's currently under investigation by ArcelorMittal, the United Steelworkers Union, and the outside agencies, probably the Indiana Department of Labor. The company saying it's going to do some, when it finds out exactly what happened, take some preventative measures to prevent, you know, future accidents in the future. It is very, steel making does remain a very deadly, you know, occupation. There have been 392 deaths now at the former Inland Mill in East Chicago since it first opened in 1902. Mm-hmm. There are, you had two deaths in 2017. It was before that, there was a period there, so 7 years where, you know, they fortunately were able to go without a, without a single death. It was the longest in the history that you didn't have any deaths there. But the United Steelworkers Local 1010, they represent the workers there at the east side of Indiana Harbor. They have the Union Hall in Hammond, and they have an annual memorial service where they mourn the fallen workers. And there are a lot more deaths in the early days of the mills. It was a lot more dangerous then. A lot of it's been automated now. You just don't have as many workers. But they're still working with, like, lava-like temperatures, with hot molten, you know, pig iron, and a lot of the equipment they work with weighs thousands of pounds. It moves very quickly. You have trains, you have steel coils that weigh more than cars. Like, it's very, there are a lot of occupational hazards there. And then, you know, every year they mourn the fallen. They have a very, you know, moving ceremony with bagpipes and family members laying wreaths, and, you know, to show that their loved ones aren't forgotten. And they release, it'll now be 392 balloons that they release into the there to mourn their fallen colleagues.
Mm-hmm. Now, the way that the mill there at the East Chicago is set up, this was a, I guess what you referred to in the story is a materials handling yard or a train yard, I guess. Do these are cars that are just basically stay within the mill property that bring material around, I guess, what, to the various buildings?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of them, some of them are even automated. A lot of them don't even have you know, conductors or anything, but they move, they're used, they're internal within the mills, and they're used to move material into, like, the blast furnaces and to keep the process going.
Right. Is in this particular case what might have been happening, that maybe that most of the time it's an automated process now? And I know you used to have lots of people on the rail yard that used to move these trains around to get them to the buildings and keep things going, keep the mill keep the blast furnaces filled and working. Does it appear that maybe that was a case that might have been maybe some partially automated process?
Oh, unfortunately, we don't really know anything about the circumstances yet. They are. They're not disclosing a lot of information at this point because they're saying, you know, it's still under investigation what had happened. The details will come out eventually. Often there's a state investigation, and they'll find that safety rules were violated. And they'll typically be, you know, the state will, like, issue some kind of fine and then, you know, mandate some kind of corrective action. But all we know is that two rail cars struck each other at some point within the mill, and he was unfortunately killed, and he was, you know, very seasoned. He had been working there in that area of the mill since, at least summer of 2007. So, I mean, he knew his way around that area. It's just, you know, you have to be just very careful at any time, and there's so many occupational hazards at a steel mill.
Yeah. Well, luckily, we have another story from East Chicago, which is have much more pleasant to talk about, and it involves the historic Marktown neighborhood. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Marktown neighborhood, which is, it's very, I'd recommend anyone who hasn't been there should go check it out. It's a very historic neighborhood in northwest Indiana. They built, the industrialist Clayton Mark back during the days when they were building out all the steel mills and refineries and everything on Indiana Harbor, built a planned worker community that was designed to look like a Swiss village in it's surrounded by some of the heaviest industry on earth. It's surrounded by the East Chicago Tin Steel Mill, the BP Whiting Refinery, ArcelorMittal Indiana Harbor, and it's just this residential enclave that's just in the middle of these hulking steel mills and the sprawling refinery and flare stacks. And, you know, some people, it's fallen off a bit. People have chosen to move further away from a lot of those industrial emissions. You know, the air quality isn't necessarily the best up there. But it was designed by a famous architect, by Howard Van Dorenshaw. He's designed a lot of the buildings along Lakeshore Drive in Chicago and at the University of Chicago campus and many other notable structures. And he made it kind of like this European village where the streets are so narrow it's famous because, you know, people park their cars on the sidewalk and walk in the streets. And it's been featured on, like, Ripley's Believe It or Not, on, it's in the National Register of Historic Places, South Shore Line posters, and they frequently offer tours, which is one thing that will be happening on April 26th, when the Marktown Historic District will be celebrating Arbor Day and Earth Day. They're planning a big, you know, not entirely day-long celebration, but a big event between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. And all the city's kind of working out the details with some of the, you know, activists in the neighborhood and figuring out exactly what they're going to do. But there will be a tour that will be offered to the public of Marktown. It'll be, you know, a chance to go and see what they call like a Brigadoon of industrial housing.
Yeah.
It's kind of similar to the, it hasn't been preserved as well, but it's very similar to the Pullman neighborhood in Chicago. I know many people have visited there and do like the home tours, but Paul Myers, who's an historian and preservationist, he leads tours to, he gets a lot of groups in from Chicago, a lot of groups in from colleges studying the history and everything, and he'll offer his tour to the general public as part of that. But right now they are looking for volunteers to help, like, plant trees and, you know, plants and everything. And if you're interested in doing that, you go to marktown.org or call 219-397-2239. That's 397-2239, because they do need volunteers to help, you know, plant trees to mark Earth Day.
Yeah, sounds like it would be a great opportunity for some community groups if they don't have things planned as they get the spring months underway to look for some projects and a chance to help spruce up the neighborhood in time for the program coming up. One other story I know that you also had online here not only deals with, I guess, economics and business, but it deals with consumer goods. And in this case, we're talking about the price of gas. Gasoline, we've seen the prices bounce all around, and that's certainly the case here in Northwest Indiana, isn't it?
Yes, a lot of people have been kind of grumbling and grousing about gas prices, as is pretty common. It does, you know, takes a bite out of people's pocketbooks, and it's also one of those, you usually don't see the prices of like bread or milk or many other consumer goods like flashed on signs, you know, everywhere while you're doing your commute. So people are a little more attentive to gas prices and a little more sensitive to them than many of their other costs. And then, you know, the cost of gasoline has risen by more than 45 cents per gallon on average in the Gary Metro over the past month. It did decline a little bit last week, but it's up. It's nearly 10 cents higher than it was at the same time last year. It's been rising. Part of the problem is that the crude oil prices have risen to about 60. They've been kind of depressed for the last few years after that big run up, and they have they've been kind of creeped up to like $60 per barrel for crude oil. But the real big thing that we're seeing right now, according to Gas Buddy, which is a gas price website and analysis, they're saying the big thing right now is the switch to the summer blend in places like the BP Whiting refinery and other refineries. They have to switch to a cleaner burning, lighter summer blend of gasoline for heavily trafficked and heavily populated areas like Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland. Like, you know, downstate Indiana, they don't do that, but they don't have the same, you know, emissions we do. But they switch to, it's a more highly refined form of gasoline. It's costlier to produce, but it does burn cleaner and it does reduce the amount of air pollution and make it easier to kind of breathe free and clear. But they're right now in the process of, like, you know, switching over to that for the summer driving season when you have even more cars on the road. We're home to several interstates and toll roads here in Northwest Indiana. Some of them, the Borman is one of the most heavily trafficked stretches in the United States. It's between that big industrial corridor,
right,
between Chicago and Detroit. I mean, we get a lot of air pollution from tailpipes, and that's why the EPA mandates that we switch over to the summer blend. But right now, that's costing us, costing us at the pumps. And then, you know, people have the common observation, like, oh, we live right next to a refinery, but gas is cheaper in like downstate Indiana. Like, shouldn't it cost more when they go down there? And it's kind of basically a seasonal thing where it's in the summer we do have to pay more because we are in this very large metropolitan area with 10 million people. And there's just so much emission from car tailpipes.
Yeah, that's the price we pay for being up here in this part of the state, I guess, to be sure. Walmart oftentimes is probably accused of not looking much to made-in-USA products, although I know they do their part to change their product mix around, so to speak. And I understand now, at least that this is an opportunity for Hoosier companies to get a chance to get into the Walmart product pipeline. Tell us about that.
Yes, critics have attacked Walmart for years for failing for sourcing like a lot of their stuff from like Chinese factories and not supporting American jobs and paying their own workers like exceedingly low wages that they can't live on. And it's been documented how many have had to go to
you know, go on welfare or get food stamps or Social Security benefit or, you know, other social service net benefits. They're trying to kind of improve their image. They've pledged to invest $250 billion by 2023 on buying domestically produced products that were made in America. And so as a result, every year they are seeking American companies that are going to make food items, toys, apparel, natural health and beauty aids, all kinds of other products here. So they put out a call out for Indiana companies that are willing to distribute through them, which would be a huge, you know, business opportunity for anyone. It's not, you know, it doesn't guarantee you're going to get on every Walmart in the country, but they are offering people to get into a chance of anywhere between like a few local Walmart stores to, you know, potentially Walmart across the region or nationally. And they are calling out like entrepreneurs that can, you know, supply them with different goods. In the past years, they have they picked up a number of different items like low-fat gourmet sauces, natural skincare products, organic breakfast burritos, naturally sweetened granola bars, pet food bowl, placemats, fog-free shaving mirror, things of that nature. They say they're spending about $1.5 billion per year currently on Indiana suppliers. And they're, you know, they're looking to continually freshen their product line. So for any like Northwest Indiana companies, it's potentially a big opportunity to, because I believe they're the largest brick and mortar retailer in the world. Amazon and Alibaba are both larger, but as far as like physical stores, they move quite a bit of product. And, you know, any local manufacturer would, you know, really be able to boost their sales by landing a deal here. You can go to like walmart-jump.com and put in an application, and then they invite the ones that they're interested in to their corporate headquarters in Bentonville this summer, and you get a chance to make a pitch directly to them. And, you know, it could potentially be a pretty big deal for, you know, a company of almost any size.
Well, finally, Joe, take a look here at a Northwest Indiana economic question, I guess. Around the newsroom, we had a chance recently to discuss the number of microbreweries as well as meaderies that are out there in the region. You wouldn't think that anybody makes mead anymore, but they do, and it's very, very popular. And there are a few in Lake County, these, of course, the microbreweries in particular, in communities like Crown Point. There are two in Merrillville. In fact, there's one literally down the street from Lakeshore Public Radio, around the corner from us here. There's some in Griffith.
Yeah, Incognito.
That's right. One of the newest ones here. And there are other places, of course, in Porter County as well, too. And I guess the question we had to ask you is sort of being our resident aficionado of the best food and drinks of the region, and you do write stories and put them in the Times about that, do you think that we seem to be oversaturated with the number of craft breweries here in the region?
That is a question that often comes up. I've reported extensively on the craft brewing and other craft spirits and so forth. And I would honestly say no. I think there's a shift. I think it's being driven by millennials. There's just a shift in consumer habits. I think a lot of there are more than two dozen craft breweries now. You do have multiple meaderies. There's the meadery in Crown Point, meaderies in Aftermath and Misbehaving Meads in Valpo. Boneflower is looking to get started up somewhere in Westlake County. You're seeing a lot of the ones are branching into distilleries even now, or craft spirits are becoming a big thing. 18th Street and Three Floyds both have their distilleries. Journeyman is looking to open one in downtown Valpo. But the thing is, I think there's been just a generational shift away from like the mass-produced lagers and, you know, the Budweisers, the Millers, the Coors of the world, and people are looking for more locally produced craft beverages. And, you know, we've seen the number nationwide. There were about 1,000 breweries total in the United States in 1996, which is when Three Floyds got started, Flossmoor Station got started, LaPorte, Backroads Brewery in LaPorte got started. And today there are more than 7,000, and it's expected to continue to grow. And I know that a lot of people seem like, oh, this is, you know, maybe too many, it's cluttering the market. But a lot of these places are strictly, like Incognito, for instance, it's strictly a brew pub that is basically only manufacturing enough beer to sell on site. So basically what they're basically functioning as a bar/restaurant, and people don't usually go around asking like, oh, there's too many bars. Are we oversaturated with the bars? Because a lot of them are just kind of like, a bar with a production component where they just happen to be making their own beer. And it just seems to be we've seen the shift in not just, you know, beer and spirits, but we've seen it in a lot of things. People are getting away from a lot of like mass produced things, and they're trying to get into healthier, like going more to farmers markets, trying to get locally sourced artisanal, you know, goods. You've just seen a shift in people's thinking where, You know, a lot of people still buy things on price and are very sensitive to price, but a lot of people are more concerned with the quality of like what they're consuming, whether it's food or beer or whatever. And then the way a lot of the people in the craft beer industry see it is basically it still represents only maybe 13% of the overall beer market, according to the Craft Brewers Association. And they basically just see it as, you know, more and more producers will come out, but they're basically just going to be gaining more of the market share away from the mass, like, you know, the Budweisers and Bud Lights of the world. It's more people's tastes and are changing. Beer sales overall have been flat for some time. People have gone more toward wine or craft, or to spirits and so forth. But craft beer is the one area that has been just growing steadily over years and years. And it won't be able to sustain the current rate of growth. And you will definitely see breweries close and everything. But it's like any business, like the ones that will close.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they've had some kind of production problems or, you know, the quality wasn't there, or they failed to find an audience or things of that nature. But for, I don't know, a lot of people in the industry that I've talked to think that this has continued kind of room to grow. It's, you know, it seems to be getting, but it was before Prohibition, you used to have breweries in every neighborhood. And it was, you know, you had a lot of like German immigrants and European immigrants that brought over the old world brewing traditions. And brewing was mostly like a local thing prior to refrigeration. It was only after Prohibition that it kind of became like this big mass industrialized, like so much of what the country was doing at the time. But then you had all the beers being mass manufactured in St. Louis and Milwaukee and so forth. And, you know, it got consolidated, but now it's kind of going back in the other direction where it's getting back toward the more, you know, locally produced neighborhood model. And that seems to be the trend for the foreseeable future. I mean, eventually the growth will slow, but it just seems to have, the landscape seems to have been changed for craft beer production. And people have been trying more interesting, you know, things like that Manic Metering Crown Point just won national awards, very prestigious ones from the Mazer Cup. And palates become more sophisticated beyond just like a very low ABV light lager, they're interested in trying like new things. And then Manic Meadery are trying new things like the ancient honey wine known as mead. And the thing is with the kind of rising tide lifts all boats with it, because with craft beer and the craft spirits, people are generally interested in variety and diversity. They're not going to stick to one. They're not just going to drink old style for 40 years. They're interested in trying like new, you know, trying new things. So it's not like a lot of the craft brewing industry is very unique, whereas they don't see themselves necessarily as competitors. They see themselves kind of more of like, there's more of a camaraderie, and they see themselves more as kind of evangelists, where they're kind of like pushing people to try like better quality, you know, locally produced beer with more, you know, sophisticated ingredients and, you know, more of a flavor profile. And then they don't really see the guy down the street as competition. They see themselves as both trying to kind of convert people away from just grabbing an 18-pack of Bud Light on the weekend or whatever.
Well, I'll tell I was going to say, Julian, I tell you, it's interesting that they should mention that here, that to be able to relate microbreweries with religion, I guess, in a way, and which I suppose it is. You know? But I suppose you're right. That is, they're very much evangelists in what they believe in, and just another good reason to believe that they're certainly not going to, besides the rise, besides the ebb and flow of business to begin with, especially new businesses, you'll see the changes. But the microbrewery industry is far from dead, and it's not going to disappear anytime soon, that's for sure. So, well, Joe, thank you for your insight, for your commentary and thoughts about the subject that just happened to come up in newsroom conversation. And we hope to have you back on again to talk about the important business stories of Northwest Indiana again.
Oh, I definitely look forward to it.
Joe Pete is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking. Seniority will be a bigger factor in Indiana teacher raises under a bill that is facing a House vote very soon.
8 years ago, then-Governor Mitch Daniels argued teachers shouldn't get raises just because they've been around a long time. He pushed through a law requiring performance reviews to be the main factor in determining raises. But Senate Education Chairman Jeff Roth says that's limited newer teachers' ability to get raises.
Teachers that had been there for many years may have been getting additional raises, and so actually wanted to push it back down to the lower level, and it kind of backfired at the lowest level, essentially. So that was the the fallout from it.
A House committee would give evaluations and experience equal weight. The Senate version would let local schools decide the proper balance. Eric Berman, Network Indiana.
A proposal that is moving through at the State House would allow school districts to ask voters for a property tax increase specifically to pay for school safety projects. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Gina Lindsay reports if it does pass, then schools could propose safety referendum to voters as early as this fall.
School corporations can ask voters to approve two types of referenda, to fund construction projects or general operations. Many districts have included school safety improvements as part of the reason for their referendum proposals, along with other expenses like teacher pay. But a House committee approved a bill this week to let schools ask for tax hikes for safety costs alone. Senator Travis Holdman said in a hearing on the bill last month, it should be an option.
So this isn't intended to be an answer for all school corporations, but I think there are a fair number who could utilize it.
The bill now heads to the House floor. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. And our thanks to the reporters who joined us on Reporters Roundtable Thursday today. Meredith Coleus-Pete from the Post Tribune and from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Giles Bruce and Joseph Pete. And thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.